This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a podcast of Checkpoint for Joy 94.9. You're listening to Checkpoint on Joy 94.9. I'm Luke, of course, and I'm now joined by a very special guest, sort of a different sort of guest for the show today. It's actually Dr. John Clark, who is president of Mars Society Australia. How are you there, John?
I'm very well, and thank you for having me along.
No, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today. And I should make it really clear straight away, because I told some people I was doing this interview, and they sort of looked at me like, almost like I said the wrong thing, or like I was talking about like Mars bars or something. I am talking about the president of Mars Society in terms of the planet Mars.
That's right. I mean, we can bring our Mars bars along, but it's all about the planet, not about the confectionery.
Exactly. Now, of course, now I'll start off, John, just by asking you sort of what is it that entails, that role, president of Mars Society? So what is it that your day-to-day business sort of entails?
Well, the society is made up entirely of volunteers. We don't have any salaried people, and we do all this basically in our spare time. We're a non-profit organisation, so we're like any other charity or volunteer group, but we also have approved research institute status, which means we've got all the rights and privileges from a tax point of view that the CSIRO has, but of course on a much, much, much smaller scale. So we do research, we do education, we do outreach, we talk to the media like I am now. We do education programs in schools, we run classes, I work with university students, and we go on expeditions to all sorts of interesting places like the Pilbara, South Australian desert, Northern Territory. We're off to Ladakh in August, and I'm also involved in two 80-day Mars simulations, one in Utah later this year and one in the Canadian Arctic in the middle of next year. So we get up to all sorts of stuff, for all the fact that we're just a volunteer organisation, but people are interested in the subject of Mars.
Yeah, that's amazing. And now I do want to talk about it as well, because it was only announced, I believe, less than a couple of weeks ago officially, and that's the Mars 160 mission, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so what exactly is that? What are you doing with that one there, John?
Well, the Mars 160 mission consists of two halves, each of 80 days. The US Mars Society has two analog research stations, which are basically simulated Mars stations. They're cylinders like giant tuna cans, 8 meters in diameter, 8 meters high, with two decks. One is set up in the desert at Utah, and one is on Devon Island, north of the Arctic Circle in Canada. And these stations are places where we do what we call analog research, where we study processes and events and features that help us understand the planet Mars, what we might find there. We can test the tools that we might one day take to use on Mars, and we can study how people interact in a Mars-like environment. There are things we don't do there. I mean, we don't have closed life support systems, partly because we don't need to test those things there, and also we don't have the funding for it.
Yeah.
But we can test how people carry out field science or field engineering, like fixing equipment or using a robot or wearing a simulated spacesuit. We can see how people's cognitive function operates when you are locked in a comparatively cramped space for weeks and months, in this case, 80 days on end. So there's a lot of work that we can do, and we do collaborate with people from NASA, from the European Space Agency, from various universities and so on, in carrying out this research. So it is peer-reviewed research that we aim to produce.
Okay, that's fantastic. Now, I mean, this basically, to me, who knows very little about this subject, but it sort of sounds like a really good chance to actually put into practice and actually try things out that normally you spend a lot of time researching and sort of, finding out information about, to actually give that a go and see how it goes in a real-life sort of circumstance.
That's exactly right. And sometimes finding the things that don't work is just as important as finding the things that do work. And also how people respond when things go wrong. How do you work around a problem? How do you deal with a broken down quad bike when you're 20 kilometres from your habitat and you're wearing a simulated spacesuit? Now, you could say, look, we will break stim because safety always comes first and we will just radio for help. Well, you can do that. But also you can say, well, look, what do we need to do? I mean, do we tow it with another vehicle? How do we hook it up while wearing big clumsy gloves? Hook up one vehicle to the other while wearing big clumsy gloves? How do we do science? I mean, it's easy to say, oh, I'll just pick up a rock. But when you're wearing something that's a bit like a big clumsy ski glove, or you're in a clothes in a suit that's got a limited visibility because you've got a big bobble helmet on your head, picking up a rock to look at it is not that close, or not that easy a task. And if you want to hold it close to your eye, there's this sort of plastic faceplate in your way, and you sort of bash yourself in the helmet, which is not a good idea. So there's all sorts of things that you need to learn. Everything takes longer. Everything is harder. You have to do it more slowly. And these are the sort of questions that we want to address. These two expeditions will be very much focused on the field science, the field activities. And so there'll be a woman from the US who's a biologist who I've worked with before. She's a crew biologist. I'm the crew geologist. And we'll be going outside and doing extensive field science as often as we can. I mean, can you do it every day or is it every other day? Can we cross-train our crewmates who are engineers and journalists and medical people to carry out many of our tasks, because there may be times when we're busy doing other things. So you want to be able to cross-train people. How easy is that to do in the field, on the job, or do they really need to be fully trained on Earth in these fields before we send them? These are sort of questions we want to address.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Now, so with all this research and with all this testing that you guys are doing, do you have like sort of a clear end goal in mind, or at this stage is it still sort of kind of figuring it all out and trying to put the pieces together?
Basically, what we're doing is sketching out the task, the problems, the methodologies that people can use. I mean, there are many, many ways that you can design a Mars mission, and many Mars mission studies have been done over the past 65 or more years.
Yeah.
We lay them all end to end, we'd probably be there by now. Some involve large crews, 15 people. Some involve very small crews, 3 people. Some involve staying on Mars for 18 months at a stretch. Some mean only staying on Mars for 2 weeks. So how you design the mission and what you try and set out will vary according to all these parameters. And until some company or country or groups of countries, a consortium of companies, comes together and says, this is how we're going to do it, we don't quite know what needs to be done. But this provides the information pool that people can draw on to design that mission once we actually make, or somebody makes that decision to go.
Yeah, sure. And look, ultimately, I mean, is this the kind of future? I mean, obviously, you can't say for sure, but is Mars a sort of place where you can see people eventually being able to survive? I mean, after it being sort of this sort of almost unknown, scary place for so long that people associate with Mars, is it possible to potentially have life on Mars?
I think it is certainly very possible that we can send people to Mars to explore the surface. We can probably have stations through which you rotate crews there, like we do in the Antarctic already.
Yep.
Or on the International Space Station. Whether we can live our lives out there and have children and raise children there, which is what settlement is ultimately about, is a question that we need to address.
Yeah.
And that is why we want to go. And we cannot find that out unless we actually try it. And, of course, if we can live on Mars, we can live throughout the solar system and potentially throughout the universe. If we can't live on Mars, a planet with substantial gravity, with many resources, then really the human race is going to be earthbound for the rest of its existence. So the question of whether or not we can live on Mars is a very, very important one for the future of humanity. Whichever answer it is, whether it's possible, whether it's not, the implications are profound.
Yeah, sure. And, I mean, something that happened, obviously, a long time ago with, first people to go on the moon and stuff like that and went down in history and, there's sort of this race to be the first kind of nation or the first country to get to that point. Do you think there is, a race? Do you think people are trying to get there? Do you think that someone is eventually going to be the first? And how soon do you think that could possibly be?
If we put our minds to it, and by we, I mean the human, you know, human race, human society, put our minds to it, we could be there in 10 years. It's just a question of will to actually implement the technology and the program to do it. I don't think it's a race. I mean, people still talk about space races. And so, for example, China puts a satellite in orbit around Mars or around the moon, or India puts one around Mars. People thought, oh, an Asian space race. That is very 60s. People are now advancing the goals. They're working much more slowly. It's not a competition. But they're working towards the goals of exploring space, of understanding space. And collaboration is as important, if not more important, and competition, because different countries, different organizations bring different skills, different perspectives that make things work. I mean, really, to go to Mars, we need the best of humanity, not just one country or one organization, but everything that we all have to offer, many different cultures, many different perspectives, many different skills.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, I guess this is sort of more recently, over the last few years, been in the media in terms of, I think it's called the Mars One Project. So people actually saying, hey, you could be part of this settlement on Mars. You could actually be involved and you could be the first people to be on Mars and to live there. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, there's certainly nothing impossible from first principles about what the Mars One people are proposing. I personally think it's a bit premature. I think we really need to show that people can live healthy, productive lives on Mars for many years before we start sending people one way. But in principle, it's possible. I also have some questions as to the feasibility of the business plan, but and some of the ways they're suggesting to going about it. But these are details, these second-level details. And the thing is, even if they fail to actually send people to Mars, nonetheless, that idea is now out there.
Yeah,
and
sure.
If you look at some of the other things that people do, like, so for example, there's a lot of excitement over private space flight at the moment, companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX and Orbital Sciences and so on. People have been talking about that for decades. There have been many attempts for people to build private rockets that can then be sold, provide services commercially to, you know, other people, other companies, government agencies, and so on. These companies are the first to actually succeed in doing it. There were many failures. And, yes, Mars One may well fail to achieve their objective, but 10 years down the track, 20 years down the track, 50 years down the track, they may well be a company that gets the business plan, that is able to develop the technology that allows people to do that. I think it's only a matter of time before that can happen.
Yeah, sure. And I think everyone's a little bit nervous because we're sort of dreading what will inevitably be the first reality TV show set on Mars with a house up there.
Well, there seems to be no limit or no depth to which the human race will sink in its quest for entertainment. But when you think about the sort of people we need to send to Mars, they aren't going to be the sort of people that you put into a Big Brother house. They're going to have to be people who are not only intelligent, not only highly skilled, but they've also got to be these people who are get along really well. They're going to be like family, and not a family that fights together stays together, but a family that actually care for each other and look after each other, because you're going to have to depend for these people for your every moment of the day, for your day-to-day existence. And so they are going to be an incredibly close knit team, or best friends, a family that are going to be reaching the challenge. It's very much going to be not an example of the worst of the human race that we see in some of these reality TV shows, but the very best of the human race. The other thing too is, of course, Big Brother and these other shows are entertaining because things go wrong. Of course, you really don't want to be watching things going wrong on Mars. So, in fact, it won't be. Much of the time, won't be very exciting what you see on your TV. It'll be people doing housework in a tin can.
Yeah.
But maybe the edited highlights will be more exciting.
Like a highlight reel, maybe. Yeah, sure. Now, look, I think, you know, people are just completely enamored with the idea of Mars. It's been referenced so many times in pop culture, in movies, and of course in video games, and we'll get to talking about Doom shortly as well. But what do you think is the fascination from people to look at Mars and see it as this really exciting adventure where dangerous things could happen? Where does that come from?
Well, Mars is the only planet whose surface we can see clearly through a telescope. So ever since Galileo's first look at Mars with telescope, through successively better telescopes over the centuries, it came to be seen as a place with, you know, a real geography, with polar caps, with seasons, with weather, with climate, with day and night. And so it became a much more tangible place than, say, the Venus, whose surface was completely obscured by clouds, or Jupiter, which has probably got no solid surface at all. It became a real place where we could imagine creatures living, perhaps wiser and more intelligent than us, and visit us and give us the benefit of their wisdom, or perhaps more terrifying and monstrous than anything here, and being a threat, or being a theatre for human adventure.
Yeah.
We could set stories that were on the old sea bottoms of Mars, or the lost world of Barthoom, if you're Edgar Rice Burroughs. And these had some connection, no matter how tenuous, the place that people look up in the sky and point to and say, oh, that story was set there. And so I think this is why it has had such a grip on the human imagination.
Yeah, sure. Now, and with so many films trying to portray that as well, do you think there are any particular films or games or anything in pop culture that you feel is a good representation of what Mars would be like, or are they all just kind of a bit silly?
Well, The Martian, I think, is by far and away the best film about Mars.
Right.
And it is the only film that conveys the grandeur of what we might see on Mars, a spectacular landscape, some of the excitement that people would feel, even in the face of danger and possible death, about walking on another planet, about living on another planet, about exploring a new world, about seeing new vistas around every corner, across every ridge. You know, other stories tell their own angle about, you know, death and adventure and monsters and so on, and they're okay as far as it goes. But for me, The Martian is the one that speaks most to me. I mean, many novels capture Mars very well. Some recent ones like The Martian Race by Gregory Benford, or Voyage by Stephen Baxter, I think are very good. Of course, the old classics, although they speak of a Mars that exists only in imagination, Out of the Silent Planet by Lewis, or The Martian Chronicles by Bradbury. These Mars visions, of course, no longer exist, but they still speak to us in many ways, even though the Mars exists only in the writer's imagination. And even though they've been written many decades ago, they can still be read with pleasure and reward. Video games, I don't know as much about video games as I do about the film or science fiction, literary fiction, but again, they're designed for particular games in mind. And so if you want to fight the demons of hell in Doom, you have that game to choose from. There are other games where you actually construct a Martian civilization, more like a simulated Mars base, and trade commodities, and there's games with that sort of focus available as well. And sometimes it's realistic, sometimes it's not. But the real gift of these games is how it stimulates the human imagination. So it's not like the accuracy that is always important, but that stimulation, the lighting of a fire of the human imagination that makes going to these places possible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it certainly it engages people. Like you said, whether it's real or not, it makes people ask those questions and start thinking, oh, I wonder how that would actually work in real life, and I wonder what would be possible. And I guess that's the benefit of having things like this exposed in pop culture, because it might be different interpretations, but everyone's still asking those same sort of questions and has that same curiosity.
Yes, when you talk to people or read biographies of people involved in space exploration. If you're Robert Goddard, the American rocket engineer who built the first liquid fuel rocket, or Carl Sagan, their imagination was stimulated, in the case of Goddard, by H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, in the case of Carl Sagan, by Edgar Rice Burroughs and his tales of John Carter on Mars. And more recently, the people who build the unmanned space probes that have gone to the onto Mars, you know, they're all children of Star Trek in the 60s and 70s and Star Wars. And so these stories, they fire the imagination, and people, what people imagine, they can end up doing, or either actually or something similar or analogous to it.
Yeah, for sure. Now let's bring it back. Let's talk about Doom now, just for a second. So now Doom is a game. It's set on Mars, and you know you are fighting, as you said before, the demons of hell. Now you know, obviously, hell demons probably not very likely. But in terms of the other things the game shows, in terms of you know the large variety of weapons and how they're shooting shotguns on Mars, and you know. In that sort of sense, how feasible is, you know, using your standard sort of human-made weaponry in a Mars kind of setting?
Well, all projectile weapons should work on Mars because, you know, a gun works because you have a small explosive charge or combustible charge that's ignited, and it's got the oxygen supply is locked up in the chemicals that make up the propelling charge. And so once it's ignited, it burns, even though there's no oxygen in the outside atmosphere.
Yep.
And, you know, the bullet goes on its way or the shell goes on its way. And that's why we can use explosives, for example, underwater, where, again, there's no available oxygen, but the explosive contains its own oxygen supply within it. It's how rockets work in space. They carry their own oxygen supply with them, and they can burn in space or in the Mars atmosphere without any oxygen. So that's all feasible. Projectiles will behave differently. There's lower gravity on Mars. There's only 38% of Earth's gravity. So projectiles will fall more slowly, which means you get further range for the same charge. If you're firing something in the Martian atmosphere rather than in a pressurized habitat, there'll be less air resistance. So again, things might go slower. If you're engaging in hand-to-hand combat, if you try to do a judo throw on someone, you'll be able to lift someone because they are much heavier than you would on Earth because they would weigh a lot less on Mars. Same mass, but lower weight. And you know, the person thrown or the being thrown would fall more slowly. So
yep.
Perhaps might be able to react more effectively to being thrown over your shoulder or across the room. So judo would be very different on Mars to what it would be on Earth. Some weapons mightn't work as well. So, for example, a chainsaw, which is an improvised weapon, it would have to either have its own oxygen supply if it ran on petrol,
yep.
Or it would have to be electrically powered. You know, a flamethrower could only work if you had an oxygen supply to burn the fuel with it, and so on. But, you know, sadly, for peaceable people like me, you know, most of our weapons would be transferable across the interplanetary space to Mars. And if we ever live on Mars, yeah, we will certainly need security forces and police forces because of human nature.
Yeah, sure. And in terms of, you know, projects that are films and games and things like that, and even books based on Mars, do you find people talking to you about, you know, asking these questions? Like, oh, can I include this? Does this actually make sense? Is this feasible? You know, do you get those people sort of fact-checking as well?
Sometimes. And of course, it's entirely their choice whether or not they take that advice. But when you're doing a creative work, be it a book or a video game or a film, in the end, it's the story that counts. And so I spoke how much I like The Martian. I mean, there are a number of features in The Martian that are pure artistic license, but that's okay.
Sure.
And of course, different types of stories apply different degrees of artistic license. So something like The Martian, which is very realistic, you've got to be very careful of what licenses you take. If it's something like Star Wars, which has very little connection with real physics or chemistry, you've got a much broader field in which you let your imagination play. So it depends what you're trying to do. Sometimes, and I will mention no names here, there have been some films which have been done about Mars, and the only comment from technical advisors is it could have been a lot worse. and again, that's entirely the right of the producers to take their own artistic vision. In the end, if it's a good story, if it's a good game that works within its own rules, that's what matters.
Yeah, sure. I mean, though, there is definitely a lot of merit to making sure that things are, you know, as close to realistic as possible, because sometimes it can break immersion when watching something or playing something if you feel like it's not actually possible. I know it's a bit of a stretch of an example, but a show like 24, for example, it's all based around the counter-terrorist unit. They actually have people that work in that unit who actually make sure that the dialogue they're using is accurate and the reports they're using are accurate and the systems look the same. So it kind of gives it the extra little boost to make you feel like, oh, this is actually what could happen. So I guess there's that element of things like Mars as well, where you'd want some sort of accuracy for the most part to at least be able to go, well, hey, this is feasible. I could see this being an actual thing that exists.
That's right. All fiction requires a suspension of disbelief, but it's got to remain credible within its own rules, whatever those rules might be. And we all have pet peeves. The Mars nut, which I happily and freely and gladly acknowledge being, something that really bugs me is how robots in Mars stories, or space stories in general, have compact capabilities that far beyond any robot ever likely to be built can do. And, I mean, it's fine in a fantasy film like Star Wars, but, you know, robots are actually really clunky and limited and vastly inferior to human explorers if you want to explore another planet, which is why Mars Society, Australia and other Mars societies around the world want to send people. But people imagine that robotic exploration of the solar system is sending R2-D2 to Mars or to Jupiter or some other, you know, amazing robot that's, you know, smarter than you, faster than you, stronger than you. So why would you bother sending people at all? And that actually is an example of how fiction can be taken too seriously and can actually impede progress. And so I would say to someone, you know, walk across the room and pick up that rock. And I'll say, and when they've done that, I said, well, it took you 10 seconds to walk across the room. That would be a day's drive for a robot on Mars. And by picking up that rock, that random rock that's on the surface, you're doing something that no Mars rover has ever been able to do. And they're quite surprised because they imagine it's R2-D2 or 3CPO and can just do pretty well everything.
Yeah, right. They're running around Mars, like, you know, shooting people and picking up things and solving puzzles and all sorts of stuff.
Yes, yes. But, of course, it's actually the people back on Earth with a communications link once a day or twice a day who are actually doing it. You know, robots no more explore Mars than your toaster cooks you breakfast. It's simply a tool that you use to do a task. You know, you don't say, oh, fantastic, I've got a robot chef, you know, cooking my toast for me in the morning. No, you've got a toaster. And the same thing, people say, oh, there's a robot geologist on Mars. Well, that's complete nonsense. There isn't a robot geologist on Mars. There's a highly complex and cranky but amazing machine that does tasks that real geologists on Earth and real biologists on Earth, you know, spend days programming to do very basic tasks.
Yeah, sure. And now, obviously, with this sort of pet peeve about robotics, is robotics something that you quite enjoy about the job that you do there?
Oh, we run robot expeditions with students, with our own people.
Yeah.
There are many tasks that robots are extremely useful for. So, for example, a robotic weather station, something that we put, you know, they're on Mars already. We will have in the future. Simple tasks like laying out solar panels for a Mars settlement or digging up sand to process, to extract water from, say, water-rich sand material would be very important. Perhaps we'd better call it automation rather than robotics, because it has a rather different image in our mind. But this sort of thing, robotics or automation, is very, very important. So use machines, do the things that machines are very good at, the boring tasks, the simple tasks, the repetitive tasks, and use people to do those things that only people can do, the creative task, the interpretation, the imagination, the fine manipulation of strange and unexpected objects, the exploring, the creating, and so on.
Yeah, sure. And I want to ask as well there, John, like, you know, you're obviously heavily involved now in Mars Society Australia and all of this great stuff, but, I mean, how did you even get involved in Mars in the first place? Like, what about it captivated you as a person, as a young person, maybe as a child, to say, this is what I want to do. I want to investigate this. I want to explore this unknown entity.
Well, I'm a child of the Apollo era. I mean, I grew up in the 60s, and you know, we got National Geographic, and there were pictures of Mercury and Gemini missions and the first unmanned missions to the moon. And I heard the Apollo 11, the first moon landing, on the radio.
Yeah.
We didn't have a TV, and followed the subsequent missions to the moon and to Mars. So I grew up in that environment, and I was always interested in astronomy and space and science, and this looked to be the way of the future. I thought that in the 80s we would be seeing people on Mars, and it was incredibly disappointing when I realized that that actually wasn't going to happen. You know, forget the 21st century. This wasn't the late 20th century that I signed up for.
Yeah.
So Mars and astronomy and space is something that's always been in my interest. I ended up as a geologist, which is, you know, studying the planet we live on.
Yep.
And then in 2001, I was surfing the net, as you do at work, and I discovered the Mars Society Australia, which had only just been set up, and there was having an expedition to Central Australia, and they were asking for people to actually plan the itinerary and the sites to visit that would be suitable to do Mars analog research. And I thought, hey, I can do that. So I emailed them, and before I knew it, I was helping plan that expedition, and then I got asked to join the board of directors, and it took off from there. But the thing about the Mars Society Australia is anybody can join. You know, we don't employ anyone. We've got teachers and researchers and engineers and, you know, school students, undergraduate university students, postgraduate students, shopkeepers, house husbands, housewives, whoever. Anybody is welcome to join, to see our website and become a member and be part of it. Because the thing about the Mars Society Australia and all Mars societies, also, it's an opportunity for people to do stuff. You don't just get a newsletter or a website. If you want to, you can actually go on expeditions. You can actually build equipment yourself. You can come up with ideas yourself and implement them, get funding for them, and be part of the adventure of putting people on Mars eventually.
Yeah, right. So there's like a real involvement. It's actually you're getting your hands dirty, so to speak, and really getting involved with this in a real way.
Exactly. And that's the different thing between, say, other societies out there, which are doing a fantastic job, is that they are more help you understand what's going on. We do that, but we're also more about actually doing it ourselves.
And now I should also say, if you're interested in checking out Mars Society Australia, marssociety.org.au?
Yes, Mars Society, one word, two S's, .org.au. And also our Facebook page, which is a closed group, so you have to join to see it, but we put lots of news items about what's happening on Mars in terms of technology that's been developed to get us to Mars and our own activities. We have members in Melbourne, and they have periodic get-togethers to movie nights and dinners and talks. We have a lot of people in Adelaide as well. So by all means, join, get to know your local members and become part of the adventure of on the journey to Mars.
Fantastic. And what are you working on? Sort of, what's the next step? I know this Mars 160 mission is the next major thing that's happening later in the year. So what's happening right now? What are you guys up to at the moment?
We have a number of things that are high priority at the moment. We have an expedition to India where we're taking Australian researchers, students, and Australian teachers over to a place called Ladakh, which is in far northwest India, not far from the Pakistani and the Chinese border. It's a high-altitude cold desert. There's permafrost. So it's an analogue for how Mars, perhaps not as it is now, but how Mars might have been 3.5 billion years ago when it was much more Earth-like. And we're going to be looking for extremophiles. We're working with people in India, university researchers in India. There'll be people from NASA, from JPL, the European Space Agency, will be coming along, and we're running the Spaceward Bound India expedition, and hopefully there'll be stuff on the news about that that people can follow. Further down the track, we've got this Mars 160 pair of missions. I'm the Australian representative on that, the crew geologist. We are also building robots in Canberra, so we have people who are working on robot trials there. We are involved in the Australian Space Research Conference, which is in late September in Melbourne, and people are welcome to go along to that and register for the conference, hear the talks. And we're also involved with building a simulated Mars rover, a sort of a pressurized rover, or like a pressurized rover, that people would explore the surface of Mars in, a high-tech campervan, if you will, and that's happening in Tasmania. And that project needs funding, donations, it needs volunteers to do some of the work on it. And if you join the society, everyone's contribution is very welcome to do. Very welcome indeed.
Yeah, so lots of stuff going on, it sounds like there, John. So lots of exciting things ahead.
Very much so. I mean, our real need, because our two big needs are manpower, person power to do the work, and funding to help us do that. We've got so many wonderful ideas of things that we can do, so many wonderful opportunities. We can't implement them all. We just like to implement the ones that we've got to hand.
Excellent. Well, John, look, good luck with everything. I mean, it all sounds just so interesting, and I hope people genuinely who have an interest or have always thought, I wonder what that would be like, just, you know, give it a go, sign up and actually get involved, and you probably learn some really amazing stuff. So thank you so, so much for taking the time to talk to me today, John.
Thank you for having me, and hopefully I'll see some of your audience on Mars one day.
Excellent. I hope so too. Thanks for that, John.
You're welcome. Bye.
This has been a Joycast of Checkpoint for Joy 94.9. If you like this podcast, please rate us on iTunes and Stitcher.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.